welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 21st, 2023. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. The first story from the front page of today's Gazette, Lost in Translation, How USDA Barriers Leave Immigrant Farmers and Ranchers Behind, by Brittany J. Miller of the Gazette. With dirt crunching under his feet, Max Chavez trekked across his 10 acres of land, grasping wooden stakes in his hands. They were marked with his handwriting, bell pepper on one, green beans on another. Every few paces, he stuck a stake in the soil, marking where his harvest would sprout months later. Chavez grew up farming in Mexico. He moved to California at 13 years old and then to Iowa in 1999. After planting and pruning grapevines around the state, he saved enough money to rent land, growing tomatoes, zucchini, peppers, and more. When asked what it takes to run his farm in Carlisle, named Sunny Valley Vegetables, 55-year-old Chavez had a quick response: money. Between record-high farm production expenses and declining farm income, producers are facing higher financial burdens than ever before. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is there to help. Most farmers receive some sort of support from the USDA, from cash subsidies for commercial farmers to microloans for small-scale farmers and conservation services to crop insurance. The department shells out billions of dollars a year for such resources. But like many other immigrant farmers and ranches in the United States, it's hard for Chavez to access or even find out about those opportunities. He said he's still waiting on funding from the USDA's Coronavirus Food Assistance Program that he was approved for, which would help him purchase needed equipment and materials. "I don't believe in them anymore," he said of the USDA. "If I don't have that money, how am I going to feed the people?" The USDA has taken steps toward increasing accessibility for historically underserved producers, including immigrant farmers and ranchers, but producers and advocates say it's not enough. They want more solutions included in the forthcoming farm bill to level the playing field. Samuel Patino, 74, grew up in the Mexican countryside, where his family grew corn, green beans, and other produce. He moved to the U.S. in 1973 and started farming 16 years ago. He now owns 21 acres of land in southwestern Missouri, raising livestock, poultry, and produce. Patino discovered the USDA only around 2014, but he hasn't successfully applied for farm operating loans or funding for a new fence. He said that's due to the language barriers he faces. Patino can understand basic information in English, but not anything technical related to farming, including how to apply to USDA programs. Even producers proficient in English, applying for USDA resources isn't simple. Applicants must decipher what programs they're eligible for and then navigate through a series of steps to be approved. They need to provide the correct paperwork, which could mean years of data to keep track of. Some even hire grant writers for assistance. Working through the maze grows even more difficult when the forms and their instructions aren't in a producer's native language. "Sometimes I feel that we are ignored," Patino said in Spanish. "We sometimes get stuck because we don't communicate very well." Language barriers are among the biggest challenges for immigrant producers, said Eleanor Gonzalez, a small sustainable farm state extension specialist at Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri. Since 2011, he has worked with Latino farmers, including Patino, whom he helped secure funds for a small greenhouse to improve their agribusiness literacy, profitability, and access to USDA programs. I believe I said Eleanor Gonzalez. It's Eleazar Gonzalez. "Most immigrant producers don't have a college education. Many didn't finish high school," Gonzalez said, "so their literacy is limited, especially in English. That makes successfully applying to USDA programs difficult. Applicants may not understand the requirements necessary to qualify, such as keeping records of transactions, nor the intensive paperwork. To add to the difficulty, most USDA applications and materials are available only in English. Translations may be available only upon request to the local USDA service center. As a result, many immigrant producers don't fundamentally understand how USDA programs work. They don't have the knowledge and information to access the resources," Gonzalez said. The language barriers work both ways. English-speaking USDA representatives have trouble building relationships with immigrant producers. The USDA is limited, especially in terms of funding and outreaching to farmers that aren't reaching out to them, said Laura Minkoff-Zern, a senior research associate and associate professor at Syracuse University. She's researching a book, The New American Farmer, which was published in 2019. She met with local USDA offices and staffers in several states around the country. Only one had a Spanish speaker. Failed efforts leave many immigrant producers discouraged, said Filiberto Villa Gomez, a research associate at Michigan State University and the Spanish-speaking outreach coordinator for Michigan Food and Farming Systems. He has worked with hundreds of Latino farmers in Michigan for about 15 years, connecting them with USDA representatives to promote applicable programs and application resources. But even with his help, producers aren't frequently successful. When the farmers make their applications, the representative said, "It's not completed. You need this and this and this." The people go back to the farm and they don't come in again, he said. The people are frustrated a lot of the time. Barriers for immigrant producers transcend language. Many still rely on cultural and agricultural habits from their home countries. Some don't trust the government enough to ask for resources. Others don't think they need the support. Those cultural barriers, paired with a lack of successful outreach, mean the USDA might not even be on the radar for immigrant producers. And in turn, they make it difficult to calculate how many immigrant producers there are in the United States. There are a lot of immigrant farmers, but we don't know where they are. They may not know what the USDA is, Gonzalez said. When we go to the community and talk with farmers, that is one reality. And when you see the census data, that is another reality. The help that is available may not be accessible to them. Some USDA training opportunities take place during the week when many immigrant producers are working full-time jobs. They don't receive enough money to work full-time at the farm, Villa Gomez said. They're hoping to get more money and live better and eat fresh fruits and products, but they must be working on the side because it's not enough. The USDA has taken several steps to increase access for immigrant producers, said Gloria Montaño Green. She is the Deputy Undersecretary for the USDA Farm Production and Conservation Mission Area that covers the agency's farmer-facing agencies, including the Farm Service Agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the Risk Management Agency. Montaño Green said the USDA is working on translating its programs for producers in their native languages. Some of the higher demand items, like parts of the Inflation Reduction Act and fact sheets, already appear in several languages. Some items are translated on a state level. Last year, the agency had more than 730 documents, including fact sheets, news releases, contracts, and forms, translated into 30 languages. But not all USDA materials are translated. Applications, for instance, are typically offered only in English, except for a few that have been translated into Spanish or have directions in Spanish. The USDA also provides free interpretation services for 14 languages, including Spanish, Korean, and French-Canadian, the most requested so far. Producers must go to their local USDA service center, where a staffer can make a call to an interpreter for simultaneous translation during the discussion. As a whole, those services aren't seeing a huge demand yet, Montaño Green said. Last year, there were 109 interpretation calls made, 86 for the Farm Service Agency, 22 for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and 1 for the Risk Management Agency. Maximo Perez knows the barriers for immigrant producers all too well. The 52-year-old grew up on a farm in Mexico. He started his own ranch in southwestern Missouri 10 years ago and now has 20 cattle. After a drought, he received emergency support from the USDA to buy grass and hay for his livestock. The English-speaking staffer helped Perez through the application process. But when he tried applying for similar disaster relief after an ice storm, he was rejected. He didn't know he had to take photos of the 5 newborn calves that had died. "I feel very sad because everything is about money," Perez said in Spanish. He had to wait another year for his cattle to produce more calves. Community organizations are pushing for USDA improvements in the forthcoming Farm Bill, which is a legislation package that is renewed every 5 years. It provides funding for various programs spanning from commodities to conservation and crop insurance to rural development. As the number of farms declines while the average age of farmers creeps higher, the future of American agriculture hinges on the success of beginner producers, such as immigrant farmers and ranchers. To get the support they need, producers and advocates alike say USDA accessibility must improve. "This is one thing for economic reasons, but also socially, we want to see equity in food systems in the country. Why not position immigrants who are U.S. residents and citizens to get that equity?" Also from the front page, city leaders and tenants rosy on the sale of Lindale Mall by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. The city and tenants of Lindale Mall are optimistic the Northeast Cedar Rapids new owner will recruit more businesses and make improvements after 2 of its longtime anchor tenants closed 4 years ago and remain empty. While transitions like this always cause a bit of chaos and a lot of work for local management, that team was optimistic about what this might mean for Lindale Mall, said Doug Newman, executive director of the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance. Newman said members of the alliance visited Lyndale Mall's local management team after the Cohen Retail Investment Group bought the 732,666-square-foot mall for $28.5 million in March. The deal also includes 9 properties outside the mall, at First Avenue and Collins Road Northeast, including the now-vacant Hy-Vee food store just west of the mall. But it doesn't include the now-closed Sears store, whose anchor space in the mall is owned by Seritage Growth Properties of New York. The local Lyndale management team, Newman said, recognizes the opportunities for development of available land within the mall footprint, and they recognize there's room for creative thinking on adaptive reuses of available space within the mall. It's a positive sign that the buyer kept current mall managers, who get along well with the mall's tenants, noting improvements the previous owner had made at the mall that the new owners may do more. The city's hope is they will be successful and be able to fill up the vacant spaces. In this purchase, the Cohen Retail Investment Group bought the former Hy-Vee food store, Jared the Galleria of Jewelry, Five Guys Burgers, Fantastic Escape, and Joanne Fabrics, and 3 parcels of vacant land and private roads along First Avenue Northeast. From just inside the front page, 1 dead and 2 injured in an I-380 rollover from the Gazette in Center Point. 1 person died and 2 were injured in a vehicle rollover on Interstate 380 near Center Point early Saturday morning. Emergency responders were called to the crash just south of Cedar Ridge Road at 3:07 a.m. Saturday, according to a news release from the Linn County Sheriff's Office. They found a white Chevy Venture van on its top in the west ditch of the southbound lanes. 3 people were in the vehicle. All 3 were taken to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. 1 person was pronounced dead at the hospital, the release states. The other 2 were being treated for non-life-threatening injuries. The names of the people involved in the crash will be released later, pending notification of the family. The crash remains under investigation. Turning to the Iowa Today section and the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, Trump rained out, DeSantis barnstorms. The showdown in Iowa between former President Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis last weekend never came through, as poor weather forecasts led to Trump canceling his Des Moines rally hours before he was supposed to take the stage. DeSantis, who has not formally announced a run for president, spoke to crowds in northwest Iowa and Cedar Rapids on Saturday and made an unscheduled stop at Jethro's Barbecue in Des Moines. DeSantis, Trump's chief rival in the Republican primary to take on President Joe Biden in 2024, made veiled references to Trump and his stop, saying the party must reject the culture of losing that's affected our party in recent years. Budget cuts target AEAs. Kim Reynolds, governor, said she's not concerned about the ability of area education agencies to provide special education to Iowa students under a $30 million cut lawmakers sent to her desk as part of next year's budget. The agencies worry an increase in private school students, who they must provide special ed for but do not get compensated, will stretch their ability to serve all students. State holds education savings account webinars. Iowa parents can sign up for webinars to learn more about the state's new education savings account program, which will be open for applications by the end of the month. The accounts will allow parents to use their child's full per-pupil state allocation to pay for private school expenses. Webinars begin Tuesday and run through June 7th and can be found on the Department of Education's website. Youth labor bill violates law, feds say. The Federal Department of Labor said a bill awaiting Governor Kim Reynolds' signature has provisions that would violate federal labor laws. The bill would allow children ages 14 to 17 to work in some jobs currently prohibited and allow teens to work longer hours. The department said the bill's rules allow teens to do light assembly work and work in industrial laundries, jobs not permitted by federal law. Republicans pushed back at the accusations, saying state laws have long been incongruent with federal labor standards. They also said some of the letter's contents reflected outdated bill language. Reynolds signs drug penalty law. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday signed a law hiking penalties for selling fentanyl and for providing a drug that results in a person's serious injury or death. The law also expands who can dispense naloxone, a medication used to reverse the effects of an overdose. Roast and Ride picks up speakers. Former Vice President Mike Pence, biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott, and conservative talk show host Larry Elder will join former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley at Senator Joni Ernst's Roast and Ride fundraiser June 3rd. The event will be held at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. Under the heading, They Said, If the election is about anything else, if it's about distractions, side issues, all these other things, if we allow Biden to just sit in his basement again and not have to be held accountable, then I think the Democrats are likely to seize that power that we know they will abuse. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in a visit to Iowa. And in the rush to expand child labor in Iowa, Republican legislators will be inviting businesses to break federal law. Protections against unsafe and exploitative child labor are there for a reason, and failed measures to address Iowa's workforce crisis is no excuse to undermine those safeguards. Iowa Senator Nate Bolton, Democrat, Des Moines, on the child labor bill. Under the heading Odds and Ends, 2024 Watch, a new super PAC launched last week to encourage former Vice President Mike Pence to run for Republican nomination for president in 2024. South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott formally announced his campaign for the Republican nomination Friday. Conversion therapy. The Waterloo City Council gave final passage to a ban on conversion therapy, an attempt to change someone's gender identity or sexual orientation, on Monday. The policy passed on a 6-1 vote. Under the heading Water Cooler, Grassley proposes ag rules. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said he is working on legislation to overturn a California law that regulates the humane conditions of certain livestock whose products are sold in the state. The Supreme Court recently upheld the law, which Iowa farm groups say will push up pork prices nationwide. Child care law. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill into law Thursday that increases eligibility for child care assistance. The law will allow people making up to 160% of the federal poverty line to qualify for child care assistance, but also require that recipients work 32 hours a week. Turning to the Insight page, some advice for the class of 2023, a TikTok graduation speech from Bruce Lear, who lives in Sioux City and has been connected to public schools for 38 years. He taught for 11 years and represented educators as an Iowa State Education Association regional director for 27 years until retiring. He grew up in Shellsburg. He writes, "I don't remember who spoke at my high school graduation. It wasn't memorable. The class before us had Dick Clark as the speaker. It wasn't the Dick, I'd give it a 5 because it's got a good beat and easy to dance to, Clark. Instead, it was Dick Clark, the Iowa U.S. Senator. But that class had 24 members and a newly minted gym to celebrate. We had 13, and by then the new gym smelled old. No senator in sight. I know I was there because I remember my graduation hat didn't fit and it kept falling forward, so I only saw the pomp and missed the circumstances. I did keep the tassel, but it faded to a weird pink color from hanging on my rearview mirror too long. I wasn't valedictorian or salutatorian, but I was in the top 10. But being in the top 10 of 13 doesn't earn a graduation speaking gig. So 48 years later, I offer my unsolicited graduation speech. Since this is the TikTok generation, this will be a TikTok speech complete with a challenge. No Tide Pod eating here. Just thank the people who got you to graduation. It may be those you consider family, or it may be a teacher, a lunch lady, a bus driver, custodian, or principal. Don't do it by email. These thanks should be face-to-face. Now, some TikTok advice. It's a short walk from the hallelujah to the hoot, bask in the hallelujah, and ignore the hoot. When you run into numbskulls treating everything as ironic, run away. They think they're always the smartest in the room. They'll drain your soul. No prince is going to give you $1 million if you send them $1,000. Be on the side of those who don't seem to have anyone by their side. There's history before you were born. Study it and learn from it. Read banned books such as The Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Bluest Eye, and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Watch Breaking Bad. It's a morality play. Practice compromising. It's an art that will serve you well. Be woke. If you're not woke, you're asleep to injustice, intolerance, and hate. Moms for Liberty may leave now to prepare the tar and feathers. If your religion teaches you to hate, maybe find a new religion. If you have kids and you're helping them with story problems about two trains traveling at different speeds, talk about who is on the trains and what they're going to do when they get to where they're going. Shun grievance politics from both parties. Vote, even if you hate politics. If you think there aren't good candidates, run yourself. If you have kids, cover your fridge with their art. You don't have to go to college to be smart, but you might need more training to earn more legal tender. Find something you love and learn the skills to do it well. Challenge authority by speaking truth. Be kind. Get in some good trouble. Stand for something. If you don't stand for anything, you'll stand for everything. Politicians who say, I never back down, think they're always right. They aren't. If you have kids, show up their sports, plays, dance, and music concerts. Finally, kiss slowly, forgive quickly. Enough said. Thanks for letting me speak. Save your tassel, throw your hat into the air. You give me hope. Althea Cole, in her To a Candid World column, writes Democrats' nominating shuffle still causing headaches. The change to the Democratic presidential nominating lineup continues to be a fiasco, and President Joe Biden's re-election campaign could face an embarrassing start due to what Politico described last Thursday as a bizarre predicament of the president's own making due to his own advocacy for the new lineup. A June 3rd deadline looms for lawmakers in New Hampshire to move the date of their presidential primary to the Democratic National Committee's new prescribed date. Should that deadline pass with no resolution, Biden could face an uncomfortable choice. Go rogue and campaign afoul of the new rules, or follow the rules he pressed for and find his name left off the New Hampshire primary ballot. New Hampshire's legislative session is scheduled to adjourn June 30th. But even if national Democrats give New Hampshire an extra month to resolve the issues that they themselves created, no one expects that New Hampshire's GOP-controlled legislature will alter their state law, which requires that they hold their primary election before any other state holds its primary, to suit the desires of the DNC. It's the latest indication that the shakeup to the Democratic nominating contest has caused more problems than it could ever hope to solve. Those problems continue to extend to the state of Iowa. On May 3rd, the Iowa Democratic Party released their presidential delegate selection plan for 2024, in which they would continue with in-person precinct caucuses to conduct certain pieces of party business, but conduct the presidential preference poll entirely by mail. It's a well-meaning plan crafted by state Democrats who will forever atone for the 2020 caucus meltdown, which, as I opined in November, wasn't entirely of their own doing. But as is par for the course with big DNC-led nominating changes, Iowa Democrats' new plan could cause its own set of problems. In an attempt to stop the Democrats' presidential nominating woes from affecting Iowa Republicans' nominating contest, House File 716 was introduced in April by Republican Representative Bobby Kaufman of Wilton. The original bill required that caucuses be conducted entirely in person and established a pre-caucus voter registration deadline. Kaufman's bill needed some fixing in order to be something other than, well, junk. The original version required any eligible caucus goer to be a registered member of their party for at least 70 days before the caucus. That would have meant that anyone not registered with their political party by the last Monday in November of this year would have been blocked from participating in the February 5th, 2024 caucuses. 70 days is too steep of an ask, especially considering current election law. That is, when readers should remember that caucuses and elections are two separate functions with two separate sets of rules. The more different they become, the more confusing they can get. What caucuses and elections have in common is that state law requires that participation be limited to registered voters. Election laws in Iowa allow a voter to remain unregistered until the moment they arrive at their polling place, where they prove their identity and residency using a set of approved documents, most commonly a driver's license. If Iowans are used to not being turned away from an election if they're not registered when they walk in the door, they're definitely not going to expect to be turned away from a February caucus if they didn't meet a deadline from the previous November. Caucuses already go a step further for voter registration requirements. State law says that to participate, one must be specifically registered as a member of the party whose caucus they wish to attend. But not all caucus goers prefer to be permanently registered with their party. My experience with registering voters, both as a longtime caucus volunteer and an election official, is that many think avoiding being permanently registered as a member of any political party will save them from the phone calls, text messages, and political mailers that are sure to clutter mailboxes before a caucus or election. It's a respectable but largely futile effort because campaigns still compile data about voters and target those voters based in part on their registration patterns. A voter who frequently changes their party registration could be perceived as a moderate or no party voter who only leans a certain way. Campaigns and parties target those voters more, not less, than the voter who's been registered at the same address with the same party for 20 years and voted reliably each election. At least they do if they want to win. If it's true that a 7-day advance registration requirement could hurt Trump at the caucus, it's also true that removing that barrier could help him, which Kaufman has denied as a motivation for introducing and passing HF 716. Importantly, though, the final version of the bill was successfully amended to remove the 70-day registration rule. Interestingly, Representative Kaufman is a paid advisor to the Trump campaign. It was also amended to require in-person caucuses only if a party selects its delegates for the purpose of presidential nominating on the night of the caucuses. If Iowa Democrats want to select their presidential delegates later than the night of the caucuses, they will still be able to keep their proposed mail-in presidential preference plan. Will HF 716, which still awaits Governor Kim Reynolds' signature, be enough to stave off further destruction of Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses? We'll see. In the meantime, questions linger for National Democrats' nominating lineup beyond just Iowa and New Hampshire. The peachy February date offered to Georgia as a reward for supporting Biden in 2020 has so far been stonewalled by Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who is refusing to split Georgia's primaries into two separate dates or move their Republican primaries up with the Democrats. I don't feel sorry for DNC or the Biden campaign. They knew exactly what this shakeup could cause. They knew that their new lineup would conflict with laws in more than one state. They knew that several of those states would not be caught dead letting the DNC bully them into changing those laws. They knew that they would be pitting state parties against each other. They knew they'd be putting candidates between a rock and a hard place by threatening them with being stripped of some of their delegates if they didn't play by these stupid new rules. They did it all anyway, and nobody is better off for it. It's a hell of a lot of hullabaloo and largely for nothing. Todd Dorman writes in his 24-hour Dorman column, Republican Attorney General launches flock of legal birds. While the Republican legislator's dismal, harmful work product was grabbing our attention, freshly elected GOP Attorney General Brenna Byrd has been super busy. She campaigned on taking on Biden administration officials, promising to give him the bird in her famous TV ad. Already, we've seen a flock of birds from Byrd. For example, Byrd has joined 21 other attorneys general in filing a friend of the court brief challenging the Food and Drug Administration's approval of the drug mifepristone to terminate pregnancies. A federal judge in Amarillo, Texas, who has rendered anti-abortion rulings previously, temporarily suspended approval of the drug, which was found safe and effective 23 years ago. But a federal judge in Washington state ordered the FDA to take no action curtailing the drug's availability. The whole thing is likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court, where reproductive rights go to die. Maybe Byrd will have a front row seat. Abortion, including the use of drugs to terminate a pregnancy, remains legal in Iowa. Byrd is among state Republican leaders determined to change that. She's not wasting any time. Byrd also added her signature to a letter signed by attorneys general from Missouri and Alabama, warning CVS and Walgreens about possible legal action if the pharmacies send abortion drugs through the mail. How far will Byrd go? A month ago, Byrd announced a pause in state payments from Crime Victims Compensation Fund to reimburse rape victims for the cost of emergency contraceptives and, in rare cases, an abortion. Byrd has said little about how long the audit will take. Forever is a good guess. I don't have any updates right now. Our office has paused payments, reimbursements to abortion providers, and providers of Plan B, and we will announce results once that's concluded, Byrd told Iowa News Now this past week. According to Iowa Public Radio News, in April, 67 claims for emergency compensation were on hold, adding up to $2,600, along with a $730 claim from a sexual assault victim who had an abortion. And yet the audit continues. This must be the most scrutinized $3,000 in state history. Byrd cut her teeth in the abortion debate, working as chief of staff for former U.S. Representative Steve King, who opposed abortion even in cases of rape and incest. What if we went back through all the family trees and just pulled those people out that were products of rape and incest? Would there be any population of the world left if we did that? King said in 2019. Considering all the wars and all the rapes and pillages taken place and whatever happened to culture after society, I know I can't certify that I'm not a product of that, King added. Now, Byrd is pillaging reproductive rights. Somewhere, Steve King is smiling. A majority of Iowans believe abortion should be legal, but this is what they voted for when they tossed out longtime Attorney General Tom Miller. Although in late March, a Des Moines Register poll showed 44% of Iowans didn't know enough about Byrd to evaluate her job performance. Wake up, folks. Byrd has also joined 23 Republican attorneys general in seeking to strike down the Biden administration's Waters of the U.S. rule. WOTUS seeks to clarify what wetlands and water bodies fall under the protection of the Clean Water Act. In April, a federal judge in North Dakota granted a preliminary injunction stopping the new rules. It was a big day for dirty water. Byrd claims that the new rules would regulate 97% of Iowa land, repeating a frequently heard lie conjured up by the Iowa Farm Bureau. Truth is, the battle over WOTUS is really about protecting scores of wetlands across the nation that affect water quality in adjacent streams, rivers, and lakes. The Clean Water Act largely exempts agriculture, leaving states to regulate it. Iowa has done a bang-up job. Filtering contaminants through wetlands doesn't make anyone a fat profit, so we're much better off draining them to make way for a housing development or a strip mall. And our attorney general is on board. Maybe they'll let her drive a bulldozer. And of course, Byrd is diving into the politics of immigration, joining a list of red state attorneys general challenging Biden administration policy, granting temporary parole to immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela if they meet certain conditions and have private sponsors in the U.S. A federal judge in Florida has blocked the practice, which supporters contend has been legal under immigration law for decades. The policy was put in place to relieve pressure on border shelters and led to a sharp drop in border encounters with people from those countries. But any policy that allows immigrants into the U.S. must be demonized for political gain. Be scared of the brown people. We have yet to hear Byrd's plan for cracking down on farming operations, meatpacking plants, and other businesses that hire undocumented workers. I'm sure it will come out right after that audit is completed. Byrd also has lent the state's voice to legal actions opposing college debt forgiveness, the war on gas stoves, and a cybersecurity rule that would require small-town water systems to beef up security. Once again, this is what Iowans voted for. A state with dirty water opposes clean water rules. A state with a workforce shortage doesn't want immigrants. Gas stoves, that's what we're worried about. It brings back memories. In 2019, Republican lawmakers who insisted Miller was spending too much time suing the Trump administration voted to take away his power to join out-of-state lawsuits. He and he alone must decide whether he serves the people of the state of Iowa or the base of the Democratic Party, said Representative Gary Worthen, Republican Storm Lake, during floor debate. Now, Byrd is serving the base of the Republican Party to the detriment of many Iowans. Not only did the legislature fall silent, but it also gave her a $1.25 million budget increase and vastly expanded her powers. But again, this is what you voted for, Iowa. And turning to the community letters and today's editorial cartoon, the editorial cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller, based in Green Bay, we see a graduate in the traditional black cap and gown holding a greeting card with an arrow pointing to the greeting card, indicating that it reads as follows. Congratulations, graduate. I don't know what to say, so I bought you this card for your special day. Sure, the greeting card company wrote this, but I signed this with a smirk, knowing you used artificial intelligence to help you do schoolwork. Today's first letter is from Gene Aarons Sippy of Swisher. Gulf states should sue Iowa over water quality. I can hardly stand to read any more about it. In Iowa, clean water versus agribusiness has gone on long enough. I am surprised that none of the Gulf states have sued the state of Iowa for its nitrate runoff negligence, shown to contribute to the destructive algae blooms in the Gulf of Mexico, which in turn is affecting their economies. I wish they would. Maybe that would at least get Iowans to wake up and demand that Iowa pass and provide funds to enforce some proper legislation regarding manure runoff from massive animal operations. I have seen their irresponsibility with my own eyes. That would be a start, as manure runoff isn't the only contributor. Iowa needs agribusiness for our economy, and we desperately need clean water. And if you haven't realized it yet, your own money, tax dollars, has been used for years to clean up your own drinking water, which has been ruined by our state's deliberate blind eye to the damage agribusiness is doing to your water. I will be contacting the states of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. Maybe they will help us. Gene Aarons Sippy of Swisher. Next, Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon writes, thanks for Gazette's local writing. I loved Aaron Jordan's Empty Nest Full Again front page story on May 14th. Wonderful feature of a mom, teacher, and her extended family. Thank you also for Like Mother, Like Daughter by Althea Cole. I love getting to know Cole's mom. And thank you for Todd Dorman's Our Leaders Have Failed on Water Quality. I'm so grateful for the continued Gazette reporting and editorials on water quality, a top three issue for me. Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon. Next, Tom Wilkinson of Henderson, Nevada, writes thanks to Cedar Rapids police officer. I want to express my gratitude to Officer Lucan from the Cedar Rapids Police Department for his assistance to my mother, Alice. Recently, she was deceived by someone who received a $1,100 payment to repair a fence damaged by the derecho, but never returned to complete the work, nor did he respond to phone calls and emails. Officer Lucan acted swiftly and thoroughly when my mother reported the incident. He promptly visited her to collect all the necessary information and personally contacted the perpetrator, convincing him to send a check. When the perpetrator failed to comply with the deadline specified by the officer, my mother informed him and he followed up until the check was received. Great work, Officer Lucan. I'd like to extend heartfelt gratitude to you and the entire department for your assistance. Tom Wilkinson of Henderson, Nevada. Next, Mark Houston of Wellman writes, Fox News is not a platform for news. I look to four news sources for state and national news. ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS provide unbiased reporting in a similar format. When one tunes into Fox News, the news becomes a platform for radicalism, racism, and conspiracy theories. It strikes me, then, we need to recognize Fox News as the outlier and not to be believed, thus fitting the definition of fake news. Utilizing common sense shows that Hannity, Ingram, Carlson, etc. are nothing but highly paid entertainers. This conclusion was recently proven with the outing of Tucker Carlson from the Fox stable. If you need to be entertained, try tuning into the History Channel and receive true factual information. Mark Houston of Wellman. Mary Hoyer of Salem writes, Iowa's elected officials must lead on climate. I recently heard a radio discussion on global warming that concluded we have to learn to live with less. I couldn't disagree more. It's not about what we give up, but about what we get. We recently built an Angingen Place home with 5 HERS rating. We have comfort, lots of natural light, and fresh air. The only thing we have less of is energy costs. Right now, a few Republicans are holding the Inflation Reduction Act, an act democratically approved by the entire Congress, hostage in negotiation to raise the debt ceiling. Meanwhile, China, our economic enemy, is already way ahead of us. They produce about 75% of the solar panels in the world. They are partnering with BASF to improve storage technology. Here in the U.S., a country responsible for at least 20% of the carbon burn since the Industrial Revolution, Republicans are fighting for fossil fuels. All 4 of our congressional representatives sided with Speaker Kevin McCarthy once he agreed to keep ethanol, when the world is switching to EVs, and China is no slouch there either. The world is undergoing an energy revolution. We must elect people who are looking ahead and insist that our existing representation take their blinders off to see what 21st century energy looks like. Are we, governed by our legislators and public policymakers, going to be leaders or losers? Mary Hoyer of Salem. And the final letter from Stephen Patton of Cedar Rapids, consequences of voting for Obama and Biden. I just returned from the grocery store. The United States is now similar to Venezuela. They have no food. We have plenty of food, but we can't afford to buy it. I don't see the difference. Who knew that voting for Mr. Martha's Vineyard and his VP 15 years ago would lead to this level of serious consequences today? Stephen Patton of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 21st, 2023, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Faljudo. Turning to the obituaries, first taking a look at the notices. Terry Hart, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, died May 14th. Celebrate Life Iowa of North Liberty Handling Arrangements. Deborah Watson, age 68, of Cedar Rapids, died May 13th. Celebrate Life Iowa of North Liberty Handling Arrangements. David J. Schluter, age 63, of Marengo, died May 19th. Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo Handling Arrangements. And Michael Dunn, age 49, of Mount Vernon, died May 13th. Celebrate Life Iowa of North Liberty Handling Arrangements. Angela Doe, known as Angie, age 69, of Cedar Rapids, passed away May 16th at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private family burial will be at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Angie loved meeting and talking to new people. She was a devoted mother to her children and to so many people that she treated as her own children. Carolyn Kuhn Hagen, age 57, passed away in her home in Cedar Rapids on April 26th. Carolyn worked in various medical places in Cedar Rapids. A private burial service will be held in Cedar Falls, Iowa, at a later date. Sandra K. Henderson, age 66, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, May 15th. A memorial service will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Sandra loved watching her grandchildren's activities, doing pottery, painting, and thrifting. Kenneth H. Wright, age 80, of Cedar Rapids, passed away surrounded by family on April 21st after a short battle with cancer. A celebration of Ken's life and 62nd wedding anniversary will be held Friday, May 26th, 4 to 8 p.m. at 716 43rd Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Anne Claire Tracy Kleeman, age 77, of Cedar Rapids, died May 17th at Hallmark Care Center in Cedar Rapids due to complication from several maladies. Tien Funeral Home is assisting the family. She taught high school Spanish in Branford, Connecticut from 1968 to 1972, after which she moved to South Dakota, where her sons were born. Her first love was teaching middle school Spanish to eighth graders. She retired from the Bridgeport Spalding Community Schools in 2004 and never stopped being a teacher, even after her death, having willed her body to science. A memorial service will be held at St. Stephen's Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids later this summer. Richard Lee Kyle Holtz, known as Dick of Marshalltown, passed into eternity on Thursday, May 18th, after a long and brave battle with COPD. Dick worked hard his whole life, and his employers included Midas, Alice Chalmers, Harnischberger, Rockwell Goss, and Universal Engineering. He retired in 1999. Dick was a proud Vietnam veteran serving in-country from 1967 to 1968. Services will be held at Cedar Memorial at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 24th, with the visitation starting at 10 a.m. A graveside service with military salute will follow at Cedar Memorial Cemetery. A lunch and fellowship time for family members will follow. Marcia Ray Yukorsky of Lisbon passed away May 17th. A graveside service is planned at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Marcia went through great challenges in her life, but she always came out with a smile. Her latest challenge was more than any one person could handle. She rose above it and came out like a trooper. She was a little sister, a mother hen, but most of all, our family's prized possession. She was born on November 18th, 1968. Rex Louis Vana of Cedar Rapids, born August 1st, 1926 in Mentor, passed on Thursday, May 11th at the age of 96 at the Donna Sandena Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Rex graduated from Montour High School, star basketball and baseball player. After high school, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy, training at the U.S. Naval Air Force Gunner School in Miami, Florida. At Iowa, he played center field on the Hawkeye baseball team, earning his Letterman's ring and becoming a member of the Letterman's Club. He also played with the Ansons, a semi-pro baseball team in Marshalltown, and coached there at a baseball school. Rex later received his master's degree from Iowa, and upon graduation spent 10 years as a teacher, coach, and mentor at Elwood High School in Elwood, Iowa. There he coached boys and girls basketball, as well as the 1961 state champion baseball team. He also taught and coached in Benton Community and South Tama. Rex finished his teaching and coaching career in Cedar Rapids, teaching there for more than 30 years. Rex was a member of St. Paul's United Methodist Church, especially enjoying Sunday services he attended in the chapel. Timothy Ray Price, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on May 16th. Tim possessed a deep passion for tinkering and assembly. Those closest to him often sought his expertise to fix an array of household gadgets and machines. He had an innate talent, much like MacGyver. He could diagnose car trouble simply by listening to the engine over the phone. Tim delighted in sharing his wisdom on the mechanics of machines with anyone who would lend an ear. In his leisure time, he could be found repairing vacuums, lawnmowers, and other small appliances that found his way into his garage. A celebration of Tim's life is planned for June, providing family and friends an opportunity to gather and commemorate his life. William George Vogel, known as Bill, age 97, of Cedar Rapids, died May 18th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 24th, at All Saints Catholic Church, Cedar Rapids, by the Reverend John R. Flaherty. Burial with military honors will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. He was born in a 1923 Model T Ford en route to the hospital in Cedar Rapids, and he felt that prompted his lifelong interest in cars and his sense of humor. After high school graduation in 1943, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy and served aboard the USS Kitkin Bay 7VE-71 and was honorably discharged in 1946. Bill worked for United Fire and Casualty, now UFG, for over 40 years and never had a sick day. For 25 of those years, he walked an 8-mile round trip to and from work. Bill was a dedicated member of All Saints Catholic Church and found himself on many committees after Monsignor Becker stopped by the hospital to congratulate him on the birth of a child and let him know where he could use a good man at church. Leonardo Lau Lim, known as Leo, passed away at the age of 88 on May 8th in Shoeyville. He was a loving husband, proud father, doting grandfather, and lifelong educator. Friends and family are invited to celebrate Leo's life during the memorial service, which will be held at 11 a.m. June 22nd in the Chapel of Mercy at Mount Mercy University. A reception will follow the service. Kenneth Clarence Melhouse, age 80, of Papillion, Nebraska, passed away Wednesday, May 17th in Papillion. Funeral service will be held at 1:30 p.m. May 22nd at TN Funeral Home, 3100 F Avenue Northwest, Cedar Rapids. Celebration of Life service will be at 6 p.m. June 15th at Grace Life Bible Church, 10606 Burt Circle, Omaha, Nebraska. Kathleen Dolan, known as Kathy, age 78, of Davenport, died peacefully Wednesday, May 17th at Meadow View of Davenport. She was surrounded by her family at the time of her passing. Funeral services and massive Christian burial for Kathy will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at St. Paul the Apostle Catholic Church, Davenport. Burial will be in the Rock Island National Cemetery, Arsenal Island. The family will greet friends in the gathering space at church from 9:30 a.m. until the time of the Mass. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Kathy spent her career as a teacher and counselor in the Davenport Community School District, where she worked primarily at J.B. Young Intermediate. Kathy was a lifelong member of St. Paul the Apostle Catholic Church. She adored and cherished her family, especially grandchildren and family gatherings. Tina Turley, age 60, of Tiffin, formerly of Amana and Cedar Rapids, left us very unexpectedly on Tuesday, May 16th, at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics. No funeral services are planned at this time, but a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Papich Cuba Funeral Service of Cedar Rapids is serving the family. Tina worked in the restaurant industry for many years and was also a nurse's aide for a number of years. She enjoyed helping and caring for others. Tina suffered with multiple sclerosis for many years, along with other health issues. Casey E. Spiker, age 40, of Anamosa, passed away on Wednesday, May 17th at St. Luke's Hospital following a courageous battle with cancer. A gathering will be held at a later date. Casey worked for Corsco Paint. He also loved car detailing and mechanics. Casey's incredible will to beat cancer was an inspiration to everyone that knew him. Francelia P. Hall Bowden, known as Frankie, please join us as we honor Frankie, June 3rd, 2023, interment at 11 a.m. at Campton Cemetery in Lamont. Celebration of life following at South Flats Shelter, Backbone State Park in Dundee, with a family luncheon to follow. And Richard H. Cope, age 77, of Peoria, Arizona, formerly of Decorah and Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, April 26th. Burial will be at Washington Prairie Lutheran Cemetery of Decorah. Turning to the sports page, State Track and Field Championships, big crowds and big wins. Williamsburg and Lisbon boys and Solon girls bring home team state titles, by Jeff Linder of the Gazette in Des Moines. When Baylor Spidell false started in the 200-meter preliminaries Thursday, it could have been catastrophic. Instead, he said it was part of a plan. "If it was God's will for me to false start, he'll make it happen," Spidell said, "but in the end, this was the best possible outcome." The speedy Spidell was a key figure as Lisbon won the Class 1A Boys Championship at the State Track and Field Meet Saturday at Drake Stadium. Lisbon was one of three area team champions. Solon's girls repeated in Class 3A, and Williamsburg shared the 2A Boys crown with Mediapolis. "I don't think anybody thought we could win this again," Solon's Gracie Federspiel said. "Losing all of those seniors, and they were awesome. We worked hard in the offseason and grew to love each other so much." The Spartans held the lead through most of the weekend and finished with 79 points, 17 more than runner-up Adel DeSoto Minburn. Spidell bounced back from his Thursday mishap to clinch Lisbon's crown, anchoring the Lions' gold medal 400-meter relay. Lisbon outpointed Columbus Community 60-52. "It's unreal," Spidell said. "It's everything we worked for. I couldn't be happier with the ending." The 2A boys' title came down to the final event. Williamsburg got to 62 points with a win in the 400-meter relay. Then Mediapolis matched the Raiders with a third-place finish in the 1600 relay. Other boys' champions were Johnston, 4A, and Pella, 3A. Girls were Waukee Northwest, 4A, Van Meter, 2A, and Calamus Wheatland, 1A. All 3 days featured record crowds. It was 10,214 Saturday and 40,567 for the weekend. And Mike Loss writes, "Getting drafted by WNBA team guarantees nothing. Cisnano, Iowa's 2,413-point scorer, waived by Sparks even after being picked 26th in the 2023 draft. How could this be?" many fans of Iowa women's basketball team wondered when last week's news was released that Monica Cisnano was waived by the WNBA's Los Angeles Sparks. How could a first-team All-Big Ten player who scored 2,413 career points and was vital to the Hawkeyes' journey to this year's national title game not make a WNBA roster? Because it's the WNBA. Were the WNBA the NBA in terms of size, Cisnano would have been on a roster when it opened the season Friday. She was the 26th player taken in April's WNBA draft. A number 26 pick is a first-rounder in the NBA, guaranteed a job for 2 seasons. Number 26 is a third-rounder in the 12-team WNBA. The NBA has 17 roster spots per team, the WNBA 12. The Sparks had just one preseason game. Cisnano played 9 minutes, scored 6 points, blocked a shot. She also committed 3 fouls and made a turnover. A few days later, she joined seven 2023 second-round draftees and first-round pick Abby Myers of Maryland as rookies who were waived. Among other cuts were players Iowa encountered at the Final Four. LaDasia Williams and Alexa Morris of national champion LSU were the 17th and 22nd players picked. Bria Beal of South Carolina was a second-rounder. Also waived was the 13th player picked, Taylor Mikesell of Ohio State. Only 19 of the 36 players drafted this year made WNBA teams. Ashley Jones of Iowa City and Iowa State is among them. She was a second-round pick of the Dallas Wings. None other than LSU President William F. Tate IV weighed in after Cisnano was cut, tweeting, "Remained quiet when my students were released. No claim of sour grapes here. But the at WNBA business model is suboptimal. Players are better served in college or with other transparent options to aspire. I hope this market learns to tap into the passion of college WBB." The WNBA was founded in 1997 with 8 clubs, but was up to 16 by 2000. League President Val Ackerman said, "This won't be the end of it. We expect to keep growing the league." The opposite happened. The WNBA was down to 13 teams by 2004 and has been at 12 since 2009. That was well before women's college basketball had made the inroads it has made, 23 years before LSU and Iowa played for a championship before a record-smashing average television audience of 9.9 million viewers, with a peak of 12.6 million across all platforms. The Seattle Storm averaged 10,631 fans per home game last season, but 8 teams were under 6,000 and 4 were under 4,000. The average crowd was 5,679. 10 years ago, 10 of the 12 franchises averaged more than 6,500 fans, and the other two topped 5,400. 20 years ago, all but one club averaged at least 7,000, and 3 ranged from 10,000 to 14,000. The average viewership for 2022 games on ABC, ESPN, and ESPN2 was a modest 379,000. Maybe this season will be better. Brittany Griner's presence will matter. She became a household name in America when she was detained in a Russian prison for 10 months. Griner's backup center with the Phoenix Mercury is none other than Megan Gustafson, the 2019 National Player of the Year at Iowa. Gustafson, who missed Friday's opener because of a foot injury, is an example of how difficult it is for many fine players to get footholds in the WNBA. She was the 17th pick in the 2019 draft, but was cut by Dallas 2 days before the season began. Many Iowa fans and others in general felt the same way about Gustafson then as they do about Cisnano today. Both were nearly unstoppable as low post scorers at Iowa. Dallas re-signed Gustafson less than a month after cutting her. She stayed with the Wings through the 2020 season. She signed with the Washington Mystics in June 2021, was cut a week later, re-signed with the Mystics 3 days later, and ended up playing 11 games. Last year, she signed with Phoenix before the season and played in 33 games, averaging 3.8 points. She averaged about 22 points in 39 games for Olympiakos in Greece from last October through April 2nd. That Gustafson is clinging to a WNBA roster spot says what we've known in Iowa for several years. She is a great player. And finally today, the Time Machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Mega Fire. 100 firefighters fought blaze a CR transfer and storage in 1964 by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. On May 22, 1964, heavy black smoke could be seen all over Cedar Rapids, coming from the mega fire that was consuming a one-story warehouse at 1201 9th Street Southwest. The fire that destroyed the Cedar Rapids Transfer and Storage Company warehouse ranked as one of the worst in Cedar Rapids history, the Gazette reported. Damage was estimated at more than $3 million, about $30 million in today's dollars. The fire drew thousands of onlookers who watched as burning debris drifted across the city, landing as far east as the Carnegie Library downtown. Police quickly put up barricades a block away from the fire to restrict the curious from getting too close. The fire department's new double-boom aerial snorkel was used for the first time, alongside old pumpers that were taken out of retirement. A gasoline transport rig was pulled in to keep the old pumper trucks running. At the height of the blaze, 100 firemen and 9 trucks were fighting the fire, with some trucks operating more than one hose. The fire was so intense, firefighters also had to spray down surrounding buildings to keep them from catching fire. The 8 people who had been inside the warehouse escaped uninjured. Fire Chief Jesse Hunter thought the fire had started as early as 8 a.m. when sparks from a nearby incinerator blew beneath the warehouse into a crawl space. The fire smoldered for hours before bursting into flame. The fire was reported at 1:45 p.m. and was under control an hour later, though a small fire crew stayed behind to watch for flare-ups. The warehouse held hundreds of new tires, accounting for the billowing columns of black smoke. Canned meats, motors, oil, roofing materials, home heating equipment, paper stock, appliances, seeds, forklifts, a semi-trailer, rubber belting, tractor attachments, cars, and beer. The building, which also housed Tip Top Distributing and an office for the Crandick Railroad, was considered a fire hazard. At the time of the fire, the warehouse had no fire extinguishers on site. Firefighters were called to the smoldering site several times in the days after the fire. Even 2 weeks later, on a windy June 9th, the fire rekindled. William Cass, president of Cedar Rapids Transfer and Storage, pledged to have a new warehouse in operation as soon as humanly possible. Cass rented most of the 1,400-square-foot Northwestern Freight Depot at 326 First Avenue Northeast to use until the new warehouse was built where the old one had burned. The new facility, opened in 1965, still stands. The lawsuits began in September when Cargill of Minnesota and Link Belt Speeder Company of Cedar Rapids sued Tip Top Distributing Company and Cedar Rapids Transfer for $250,000 combined to cover the property lost in the fire. Pepperidge Farms sued for about $100,000. Modern Appliance Company filed papers seeking $67,000. That was just the beginning. 12 insurance companies filed suit next. In December, Cedar Rapids Transfer and Storage sued Tip Top Distributing for negligence, saying Tip Top employees had been burning debris next to the building the morning of the fire, had failed to extinguish the fire, and didn't have equipment to put out the fire once it started. A settlement between all parties was reached in October 1966, but the terms were not released. Cass, the warehouse owner, sold Cedar Rapids Transfer and Storage in 1986 and moved to Florida. It wasn't the first time a warehouse connected with Cedar Rapids Transfer and Storage had burned in Cedar Rapids. In July 1905, a four-story building at A Avenue and 4th Street Northeast caught fire. It was owned by the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railway and leased by Cedar Rapids Transfer. Spectators found prime viewing area on the A Avenue viaduct to watch the fire until intense heat drove them away. The fire apparently started on the warehouse's main floor. A cause was never determined. The transfer company immediately drew plans for a new five-story concrete and brick building on the same site. In 1950, when more space was needed, the transfer company bought the 270 by 150-foot wood frame commercial property at 1201 9th Street, Southwest. That brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 21st, 2023. On the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service, I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table, and there's a chipmunk on my back deck. I hope he stays outside and doesn't come inside. We've had chipmunks inside before. Not fun. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other recording on our website at any time, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.